My name's Chris Kirk, and this is TW Talks, the interviews podcast from Free Weeks Edinburgh. I'm still talking to performers who have shows at this year's Edinburgh Festival, sitting down in the Assembly Club bar to talk past, present and future. With each guest, we talk career so far, this year's show, and what is happening next. Today, Tom Tuck, who is performing Scaramouche Jones at Hoots at Potter Row at this year's festival. Let's get TW talking with Tom. So we are back in the club bar at Assembly. I have another guest joining me. Tom Tuck is joining me. Thank you for coming in on this Friday, I think.
It is indeed a Friday.
It's quite hard to remember what days of the week are.
For me, it's easy because one of the shows I'm doing runs Sunday to Wednesday.
Ah,
so I know last night I got to bed early.
So it allows you to know where the hell we are in this mad month. So past, present and future is our format. Mm-hmm. We're going to talk about your career today and then this year's show, although they kind of go hand in hand.
They do. The show this year is Scaramouche Jones, but it was also the show in 2005 and also the show in 2015.
So had we been doing 3 weeks podcast in 2005, and I don't think we were. We were quite early when it comes to this thing called podcasting, but whether we're doing the 2005, we were definitely doing podcasts in 2015. Mm. But we'll talk about that in a moment. But I guess let's start off with your sort of career to date. So although most of my podcasts are with people who are in the comedy part of the programme. Actually, I'd noticed your show's in the theatre part of the programme.
Well, it is a published work, darling. It's not mine, but it is a published work.
But your experience here at The Fringe and elsewhere, the mixture of the two.
It is very much a mixture of the two, yes. Have I been in any other section? I don't think so, but I've been in theatre and comedy sections of the printed brochure many, many times.
So in terms of pursuing career as a comedian and actor, when did that all begin, if we go back, even before this show?
I think I knew I was destined, well, I wanted to perform. And then in everything I did at school, every play I got into, I was always the comedy part. So I was just told, oh, no, you're the funny one. So it sort of became a thing. But I think that is all a spectrum. All performance is a part of the same thing. So I knew I wanted to perform. And latterly, I've become a musician as well. And I've been playing every day up here. With a sort of a bunch of misfits that we call the Hospital Bombers. And that's been very good. Peter's just arrived, so we were a five-piece briefly yesterday. and we've picked up other waifs and strays along the way. But I've never been in the music section of the guide.
Yet. There is still time in future years. And so I suppose, obviously, you've had a lot of connection here at The Fringe for a long time, but you also studied in Edinburgh. We both studied at Edinburgh University. You're a little bit younger than me, so I don't think we actually collided. But I guess when you were here studying whatever it was you were studying, I have no idea.
I have an MA in mental philosophy.
Well, there you go.
Because Edinburgh still called it mental philosophy.
But
a holdover from the 1700s.
Beyond the mental philosophy, you did a lot of comedy and theatre and performing.
Yeah, so I joined the Improverts. Which is the Edinburgh University Improv Troupe. Of course, you know, but the listeners might not. After doing two plays in my opening term at Bedlam.
So Bedlam being the Edinburgh University Theatre and Theatre Company.
The end of George IV Bridge, the neo-Gothic carbuncle that it is. The first play I did, Miles Jupp, played my dad. And he said, join the Improverts. The amount of time you get to stand on stage and be funny will stand you in such respect. So I got into the show by January of my first year, I think, and was brilliant in my first show, and then terrible week after week after week after week after week, until Gemma Fairley, who director now, also improv, handed me Keith Johnston's impro for the Easter holidays. Said, look, read this.
There is some theory to this.
Read this, and maybe you'll learn. And it was with a formative thing for me. Came back and realised that, I mean, the being terrible again and again and again, but essentially very low stakes, but it doesn't feel like it's very low stakes when you're playing to 90 people as a 20-year-old or 19-year-old or whatever I was. It feels high stakes when you're rubbish. God. But you can't not be rubbish for a bit. You've got to internalise what it is that the process of making people laugh is.
And as you say, although 100% in the room on the night when there's a room in front of you expecting you to be funny, it's very stressful. But actually, in a way, that's what's brilliant about, you know, theatre and improv and comedy within the student environment is, okay, but it's only 90 people.
The opportunity to fail.
Yeah.
Again and again and again and again and again until maybe you don't. I remember the constant feedback from other improverts was, yes, that was clever, Tom, but it wasn't funny. Yeah, but I made a reference to Christ and nobody cared. Well,
narrative's important, you know, surely. I bet that's what your book told you.
Yeah.
So obviously Improverts was a year round thing, still is, in Edinburgh, but you had lots of fringe experiences along the way. And I guess, you know, when did you start, beyond the sort of the student theatre staff, when did you start doing your own thing, whether individually or as part of a group at the Fringe?
So 2006 was when Penny Dreadful started, because all four of us were Improverts, and there was four of us for the first 2 years, and then Jamie left, and there was three of us for the next 3 years. Sketch group, initially Victorian themed, and then no theme whatsoever. And we had five very, very good years, and then
and also that went well beyond Edinburgh, didn't it? Have it started here? Am I right in remembering it started as a Fringe show?
Fringe, we did our first show, I think, must have been November 2005 in Bedlam, as a kind of like, what the hell is this? And we learned so much from that. Went away, rewrote, and then did Underbelly Cowgate in 2006. And 2007, moved to Pleasance 2 in 2008, when we sold every single ticket of the run. And then 2009, we stayed in the same room, and we on the form, we were like, 2 days off, please, this Saturday and this Saturday. And Ryan from the Pleasant rang us and was like, you've made a mistake on your form.
Who takes Saturdays off?
We don't like them. They're worse audiences. But you'll sell out.
We'll sell out Mondays. You just watch us. And we did.
then we preemptively booked extra shows, didn't sell those.
So that was our limit. So the by popular demand shows turned out
not wasn't quite popular enough. Yeah. No, yeah, that was our limit, really, because the next year we went to Pleasance One, and Mondays were tough.
you were really looking for those Saturday drunk
kids. Yes, really. Well, Sundays were fun, but it's almost twice the size of Pleasant. Yeah. So, it was a good show, and I think we had five pretty good shows, and one of them I think was exceptional, which was 2008. When, if you look back on Wikipedia, at the number of nominees for the main ward, there are only four. Why? Because we were booted out at the last minute. Because
there was a technicality, I'm vaguely remembering.
Yeah, Bruce Dessau. Damn you, Bruce. Bruce Dessau argued that because we were a play, we were ineligible.
That's right, but because you'd gone from doing sketches to, like, doing a 60-minute story.
Yeah, but it wasn't as if we wanted to tell this story. We just thought that was the best delivery method for the stupid jokes we were doing. Apparently, because they'd spent so much time arguing about it, they forgot to speak about the panel prize. So that's the year everyone won the panel prize. So technically, I think we
But again, I suppose that comes back. We started off by saying, do you put yourself in the theatre strand of the programme or the comedy strand?
Well, yes. There we go.
And I mean, the ramifications of that we do slice the programme up. And I guess, obviously, in the days of the prints, it's really printed the brochure you in. But I guess, I mean, I'm guilty of this. I go into edfringe.com and I do pick genres on what I'm in the mood for. But I guess as a performer, particularly as someone like yourself who does very much across all of those things, it's kind of annoying to be forced to say, oh, this year's show is comedy and this year's... And I know you get to have, because I think you've got comedy as like your secondary thing for this show.
Yeah.
But it's a tricky thing to force you to pigeonhole yourself.
Yeah, I mean, because when I did my first solo show in 2011... I put it in comedy because I wanted to be eligible in it. In fact, I did get nominated.
So eligible for the award. If you're not in the comedy section, they don't even look at your show.
Yeah, and so I was eligible for the award, and I was nominated for newcomer in my 9th consecutive year at Friends. But it was my first solo show. If you don't count Scaramouche, which was in the theatre section. But actually, if you look at that show, it could quite easily have gone into the theatre section. It was a strange, strange thing. The format was stand-up comedy, but it wasn't necessarily stand-up comedy. It had these strange sort of dark, lyrical, poetic bits, and ended on a cover of a Disney song. And like, it could quite easily have been in the theatre section. And indeed, it went to a couple of theatre festivals, but didn't go to any other comedy festivals.
When they added the spoken word strand of the programme, because for many, many years, spoken word didn't know where to put themselves, and we got spoken word strand. I remember the joke the first year was, there would be some spoken word acts. Well, I'm going to go in spoken word, but it turns out people laugh. At the end of the first week, I want to move myself to comedy.
Well, at the end of the first week in 2011, I had to give up knowing what the punchlines were, because I thought I'd written jokes in a row, but people would laugh at the setups one day and laugh at what I thought the punchlines were the next day, and I was like, okay, this is just a series of sentences I've written. But then I read Steve Martin's autobiography. He deliberately trying to withhold punchlines, so at the end they had to laugh, and he goes, oh, that's ended up being what I had to do. Just had to keep saying the things in a row. And at some point, the tidal wave will take over.
So that year when you did the solo show, the show we're here to talk about, you had done solo stuff, but more sort of theatrical. Having been in that, well, first of all, The Improverts, then Penny Dreadfuls, was it quite nerve-wracking within the comedy space to suddenly be, it is now just me, I'm not...
No, because I'd been doing stand-up.
Of course.
Alongside, I'd started that in probably 2002 or 2003. And just, you know, we're just doing occasionally, I've got this idea, I'll ask the stand if they've got 5 minutes here, or I'll ask to do the... And so when we collectively decided, as Penny Dreadfuls, we're not going to do a sixth show, that set seems like enough now. Maybe we'll come back sometime, but at the time we were like, just not this year. It's like, right, I'll gather some ideas that I've had over the years together. And then that fell by the wayside because this stupid idea popped up. And so I was just like, oh, well, I should. It felt very natural to be like. And then as soon as I said, oh, I'm going to do that, the other two went, oh, we'll do one as well then. And of course, Humphrey beat me to the award.
Well, we sort of skipped over the show we're here to talk about on that journey. So in 2005, 20 years ago, mm-hmm. the first time you did this show.
Yes.
So if you can think back that far, what was the motivation at that point? Bearing in mind, you'd done the improv stuff, the sketch comedy stuff was building. Why did you start in 2005?
Well, it was actually November 2004. I auditioned for the play. Charlotte Jarvis, who's now a visual artist, I don't know if you ever met her, crossed over with her. The year below me at Edinburgh, found this play, wanted to put it on. I said, one man play, yeah, I'm up for it. And I didn't get the part. Al Smith did, playwright Al Smith. And then he quit after 2 days because he said, there's no way I can learn it. And so I got the part. And what ended up being the sort of role of a lifetime, I got by default.
On the reserve list.
On the reserve list. Yeah, first sub. And it's a 100-year-old clown who walks off stage after his final performance into his dressing room and just starts talking. And we took the Fringe in 2005 in Bedlam, far too late at night. It was at 10:30, I think. Too late. Too late for a play at the Fringe, so... We didn't get very many bums on seats, but there's very little financial risk if it's a BETC production.
Yes, the student theatre company, it's their own production in their own building, and not many people involved because it's just you and some people.
Me, James Turner Inman, Claire Glendening, Charlotte Jarvis, Jono. Not many people. Like,
oh, and all involved in the student theatre,
and none of us were being paid.
Exactly.
And also Improverts. kind of pays for
yes.
kind of pays for all the other productions. And so not that many people came, but those who did really liked it. Like, oh, that's interesting. And it had been to the National Student Drama Festival before that, and I got to work with John Wright, the clown teacher and director. And it just felt like, oh, this is a good piece of work. I'm very proud of it, very proud of it. And then in coming up to 2015, I thought.
Yeah, so you've done all the Penny Dreadful stuff. You've done sort of basically a stand-up show and solo comedy stuff out the fringe. And then the 10-year anniversary was coming up.
And I thought, that'd be interesting, because I'd be 10 years closer to the age of the character. And also, hopefully, 10 years more skilled. I've got 10 years more hours standing on stage making people laugh. And, you know, other things as well, you know, because it's not just a comedy. What? Comic performer. Tragic performer. Quote from the show. Justin Butcher. And here we are 20 years later.
So what motivated you, I guess, because it was that nice, neat decade from first show to second show.
From first to second.
In sort of like, OCD brain, it was sort of like...
It was just like, yeah, that'd be interesting, And I didn't have like a solid plan of what I was going to do, so I'll put that in the diary. I did a stand-up show as well, but I'll put that in there. Okay, that's something to work towards. 10 years, and then coming up to the 20th, I was like, yeah, I'm going to have to do it again, aren't I? Because if I do it every decade until I'm dead, that's funny.
It's definitely And maybe funny. You will get to the age of the character.
Well, yeah, I'll be... to be honest, if I do it when I'm 73, I'll be very proud of myself. But yeah, the plan, I'm 43 now, and... next time will be 2035. Book your tickets now. I haven't confirmed a venue yet. Why do you reply to the emails?
Very inefficient. On
I know. I know. You think they'd be jumping at the chance.
You sort of alluded to this when you talk about the 10-year, the 2015 show. I mean, yeah, I guess in terms of, has your relationship with the piece changed on each of those iterations? Because 10 years actually... quite a long time, a lot.
Oh, yes, yeah.
And the world, a lot's happened in the world in each of those decades.
I don't think my relationship with the piece has changed, but my facility to deliver the piece has increased. I'm very proud of how I'm able to control tone better than I was 10 years ago. And I thought I was pretty good 10 years ago. So 10 years ago, the first time was too late, and the second time was too early, so 12:15. So none of my comedian friends would get out of bed to come and see it.
Finally found a time slot that works.
2:45. It's lovely.
It took 20 years to get the time slot.
Yeah.
Got it right. So moving on to future. I mean, said that, we've kind of already talked about the future for this specific show.
2035.
Get that in our
diaries. I think next year I'm going to do a stand-up show.
So I guess, because we've talked about your sort of first 10, 15 years performing at the festival, but I mean, you've been performing at the festival pretty much ever since.
And again, it's pretty much, I think it's my 23rd.
Yes. And so, a mixture of sometimes doing the comedy stuff, sometimes you've been in other theatrical productions.
Been in kid shows, been in plays, been
and then
musical.
Performed other comedians in theatrical stuff along the way.
Yes. Did Coalition, where I played definitely not Nick Clegg for legal reasons, with Al Barry and Joe Caulfield and Phil Jupitus. Did a play about Brexit a couple of years ago called Dom, about Dominic Cummings, when there was one person playing Dominic Cummings, one person playing Boris Johnson, and me playing all of the other men. And then someone playing all the women, and occasionally some men, because there's so many involved. I've done all sorts.
I mean, obviously... people who've, like both of us, who've been coming to this festival for so bloody long, there is sometimes the narrative of, it's not as good as it used to be, it's too commercialised, it's too expensive, blah, blah, blah. But I mean, can you, I mean, other than obviously 2035 is a commitment, but I mean, can you imagine you get to the point where it's like, I've done with the Fringe, or for the foreseeable future, every year, there'll be something.
For the foreseeable future, I will be here, yes, 100%. I generally figure out what I really want to do at next year's Fringe, in the last couple of days
of this year's
Fringe. 2 years ago, we're like, oh, I know what I'm going to do, and I wrote on my jacket what the title of the show was going to be, which won a Malcolm Hardy Award for Comic Originality last year, and my show Times Vary, which wasn't in the Fringe Guide, and was at a different place at a different time every day, so people had to find it.
So maybe next year, not a impossible to find show.
Probably not.
Probably done that.
Yeah. Although looking into the future, beyond this Fringe, but only just, are you still here on the Tuesday?
I am not, but people will be.
People will be, because I will be doing an unrehearsed reading of the second half of the screenplay of The Princess Bride.
Wow. That's a post-Fringe treat.
Post-Fringe treat, and the day after I'm going to the zoo.
Well, that's a good plan beyond the madness.
Yeah, and next year's show, I think, is going to be called Heartwarming Animal Content.
Oh. Well, we can leave people to imagine what that might involve. And then find out if you can find an appropriate time slot to stage it. But before that, we should stop talking about the future. There is still another week of this Fringe to go. So maybe run us through the time of day, the venue where people can see the show.
It's at 2:45 at Hoot Potterow. So there's a yurt.
Yes.
Which is a pretty good facsimile.
Just under the underpass, right?
Just past the underpass, yeah.
Pleasance and all of that.
You go Pleasance Dome, the underpass, on the right is the yurt. On the left is a shipping container.
You don't want the shipping container.
We do. You do if you want to go see Leslie Ewing Burgess at 7:40, which I'm going to do tonight. which I'm doing some notes on. Very fun show, but she's not getting enough people in, so do.
Go to both container and yurt.
Go to both container and yurt. And they've got a little bar there, and that's also where the band have been playing.
So you're very much in that little...
Yeah, and if you come slightly before 2:45, I will be in full clown makeup, doing clowning on the street before the show, because I'm a glutton for punishment. And then afterwards we'll have some carousing with the band.
And final question is, where can people find information about you and the show online?
I'm at Turlygod, T-U-R-L-Y-G-O-D, which is the quote from Wick's Shakespeare play.
Oh, I should know that. Given you've had that handle for a very,
very long time.
My Shakespeare ignorance is on display here. Maybe, or listen,
I mean, to Lin-Mel in. The question is essentially, name a Shakespeare.
Hamlet.
No, it's Lear.
Lear.
There's a bit in which Edgar is on the run after being accused of a murder he didn't commit. And he pretends to be a mad beggar called Poor Tom. And at the end of one of his mad speeches, he goes, Poor Tom? Poor Turlygod? Poor Tom? And in my annotated edition at sixth form, it said, there is no satisfactory explanation for this.
I thought, well, I'll have that. And I'll have that when Twitter came along. Well, then use that.
So it's my email address. It's Instagram, Twitter, Magic the Gathering online, across the internet. If you just Google Turlygod,
you will get
me and Shakespeare.
Well, then. Hopefully you first.
I think, yes, now.
Yeah. And then Shakespeare.
And a guy called Luca from Italy.
Well, people should check that out. Thank you for joining us, and let's agree to regroup in this little basement of assembly in 10 years' time.
10 years' time.
To discuss show, performance number 4. Thank you.